session number 26542, Reel 2.
Dan Hancock's Reel 2.
Okay, so yes, so that just left Mum and Mary and I at home, and with Mum, with the, if you like, the male members of the family all the way. And this was the Twilight War, of course. Nothing was going on.
What changed about your life once war was declared?
What changed? Well, there was a blackout for a start. You see, we had to make sure that you had blackout curtains across all the windows to make that there was no lights on that could be seen outside. The house itself was made like a fortress because we had sticky tape across the windows. We had a bucket of water and a bucket of sand on by the front door in case of incendiary bombs. This was long before the Blitz started. and I can also, I have this recollection of one morning, the milkman came to the door, and in those days, they weren't delivered in bottles. It used to come round in a big wagon with a metal cistern or geyser, I suppose, and he would ladle the milk out into jugs, which my mum, everybody in the road did, and he would have. And I can remember him coming up, and Mum had buying the milk, and he said, "Of course, did you know the Courageous has gone down?" And I didn't know what he was talking about. So Mum said, "Oh, I am so sorry that that's gone down." Whether she knew or not, or just sympathetic, I don't know. Because, obviously, when the papers came out the next day, that was the first British ship to go down. It was HMS Courageous, the aircraft carrier, had been sunk within a week of the war. So then I thought, well, you know, it's come home to us. And here I was 14, and I couldn't do anything about it. Too young. My father and brothers were away. But I did join, as I said, the ARP, because at 14 you could, and I became a messenger boy. And I also joined the Sea Cadet Corps.
What's the ARP and what did you do?
Oh, ARP, it was short for anything to do with air raid precaution. And I was a messenger boy, because of my age, obviously. And there were several messenger boys attached to a first an air raid warden's post. And we would have to cycle around other posts within the area with various messages. Of course, you know, they didn't have the communication system those days that we have now. So, you know, the post warden would write out a message to the post warden somewhere else, and we would cycle off with it and deliver it and take the answer back.
Was that during air raids?
No. That was, that was part of your function. I had to do, as an air raid, as a messenger, I had to do two evenings a week. When I say evenings a week, from 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock. But those duty wardens, because it was all civilian, the volunteers, the duty wardens, they would man the air raid post from, I think it was, they did start about 6, and they would go right through the night, and they would finish at 8 o'clock the next morning before the permanent wardens came on. And these permanent air raid wardens would man the post, and we had two on our post, and they would man it 7 days a week. We would release the older people would do them for the nights. But we used to have to do three nights, 3 hours, 2 nights a week.
And how old were you?
14, 15. And in the meantime, as I said, I also joined the Sea Cadet Corps at Richmond, and I used to go there one night a week, and Saturdays and Sundays. Cycle there from home.
and learn, if you like, the skills of being becoming a seaman, which, you know, when I eventually did join the Royal Navy, I could, you know, I knew all the terms, I knew all the knots, and more importantly, I think, how to put the uniform on, because it was quite a complicated uniform, the blue jacket uniform. And when the time came and I did join up, I knew, when we were issued with it, I knew exactly how to put it on, and used to show the others how, because they didn't show us how to put it on. It's just a question of, you lined up, I'll come to that anyway later on. So I learnt that skill.
What made you join the Sea Cadets?
Well, I didn't think that the Scouts, I never went into the Scouts, I was a cub, but never went into the Scouts. I wanted to do, I thought that the Sea Cadets, if you like, was as near as I could get to get in the Navy. You see, there were Army Cadets and there were Air Cadets, but I wanted to become a Sea Cadet. It was a pre-service training unit where we had the discipline, and there was the band, and all sorts of attractions. There was the band, there was the uniform. We used to march through Richmond on church parades. Yes, I suppose that was the nearest you could get to be associated with the war effort, if you like. You know, everybody was. Well, the Phoney War was on for a start, and I thought, well, you know, I'm still too young to join the Navy proper, but this is the next best thing.
But what attracted you to the Navy in particular?
I can't honestly say, except that, you know, way back I had seen the big ships of the fleet coming out of either Channel or Sheerness into the Thames Estuary, and I thought, well, that's where I'd like to go. I'd like to be a sailor. Because the background, they were all soldiers, all been in the army. Nobody had been in the Navy at all. But it was, I suppose, I can't honestly say at this stage what attracted me to the Navy, but I wanted to be a sailor. Wanted to be joined the Royal Navy. In fact, I went through a stage where I thought, I'd like to join the Scottish Navy because I picked a book up in the library about Scottish tartans, and I was reading them, and you know, and then talked about the MacDonalds and Glencoe and one thing and another, and the Jacobite Rebellion and all these things, and the Scottish regiments in the Empire's Wars. I thought, oh dear, I would be rather attracted to one of those. I wonder if they've got a Scottish Navy, because I hadn't realised that it was all part of the United Kingdom anyway. So, but anyway, I got into the Royal Navy eventually. So I can't honestly say what attracted me to the Navy, but that's where I wanted to be, and that's where I ended up.
Can you tell me more about life before you joined the Navy, during... Well, living in wartime London, what was that like?
Well, it didn't. When you say wartime London, we never used to go into London as such, because we were in the suburbs, if you like, West 3, Acton, West 3. I used to have to cycle to school, of course. There was the rationing. Mum had to try and make do with you know, the small rations that we had. We weren't affected too much by the wars until I can remember May 1940, when the Germans invaded through Holland and Belgium, Luxembourg and France. Because just further up the road from us, there was one of the neighbours. He worked for a Belgian firm on the factory estate, and my mum said, God, that's now making a bit of a noise next door. So and went to the front door, and he was shouting. He was going off to work, and he was shouting back to his wife, who was at the front door, I expect we'll be all right. I'll let you know what happens when I get home and all that. And we said, well, what's going on? And then she said, oh, I forget his name, Mr. Benton, I think you were, or Benson. She said, well, he's a manager for this Belgian firm up on the factory estate. You know, perhaps he's going to be out of a job. But what would we do with one thing and another like that? So what's it all about? Well, you know, the Germans have just invaded and all this. Oh, but we'll throw them back. Don't worry about that. We'll go into Belgium, we'll go into Holland, and we'll sort the Germans out. And people up and down the street, we're all out in the street there, because something had happened. And somebody had got a wireless going and told everybody, and it ran through the street like wildfire. And we also had soldiers billeted on us in the street. And of course, they were all concerned that, right, you know, the war's really started now. Perhaps, you know, we'll be sent to France or whatever. But that was a memory because, as I say, it hadn't affected us to that extent, other than rationing, of course.
Your father had been called.
Oh, no, Dad.
So was he still allowed to live at home, or was he?
Oh, no. He was in the Middlesex Regiment, and he was in the barracks at Mill Hill, although he probably would have been too old to have been sent abroad anyway. But being a territorial, he was called up. And Dennis was, that's my brother, elder brother, was somewhere in Essex, I think, with an anti-aircraft unit. Leslie, I forget where Leslie was, but I think he was with a training battalion or something. So we then, you know, we used to go to school, cycle to school, and think, well, what's going to happen now? The teachers say, well, look, it's okay. Just because the Germans have invaded, you know, you've still got to learn your lessons. You've still got your examinations to face and all this business. We'll be okay. Because all the teachers at that stage, they'd all been veterans of the First World War, and they were convinced that, well, you know, we were going to win this one. Then, of course, came the Battle of Britain. We could see the fibre trails and we could see the fighters and running. And of course, Norfolk Aerodrome wasn't too far from where I lived. And so we could see what was going on there. And the daily forecast, so many aircraft fall down. And we were convinced, you know, that we were going to win. Right from the word go, we were going to win. Norway happened, of course, then Dunkirk, and we were all fretting. I can remember, you know, all the boys in my class, or most of the boys in my class at school, we were just hoping that it would last long enough for us to get in and do our bit, I suppose. You know, it's back to Fear God, Honour the King, you see.
Did many people from your school disappear? Were they evacuated?
A lot of the boys who evacuated to Twyford in Berkshire. And so what those people that weren't evacuated, they put them all into, instead of perhaps five different schools, we all went to one school. So various county schools, we were all marshalled into. I went to, although I was at Acton County School, and they were evacuated, and I wasn't. Many of us weren't. We carried on our education at another county school called Drayton Manor. So we carried on with our normal education, although Drayton Manor was further to go than my other school, but you know, with a bike, no problem at all. And there was certain kudos in being an air raid warden messenger, as I was, and I mentioned, is that you used to have to wear a tin helmet, and you had a different type of gas mask to what the normal people had. And it was a gas mask that fitted over your face with a tube and fell into it, almost like a service gas mask. And we used to, we used to always have to carry your gas mask about with you wherever you went. And so those of us that were messengers in the ARP, we used to have carry our gas masks over our shoulders and cycle to school. And that was one up on those that weren't messengers, you see, because they used to have this little wooden cardboard box with the ordinary respirator in. So there was a bit of one-upmanship that, you know, you were that much more evolved than they were. Because a lot of the chaps were saying, you know, well, I'm going to join the army, or I'm going to join the air force, or I'm going to join, or I'm going to wait to be called up. But if you wanted to get into a particular service, you volunteered for it. But generally speaking, you see, although you volunteered, you weren't called up until you were 18 anyway. And if you hadn't volunteered, you were called up and you were sent where they thought you should go.
What about the air raids? Did you suffer much from that?
Yes, the air raids started August, September 1940. And, this is when they were bombing London. And where I lived was very, very close to the Park Royal Industrial Estate. Which all the heavy engineering firms there, and night after night they used to come over and bomb. And on reflection, you see, they wanted to take Park Royal out, wanted to destroy it, obviously. But of course, quite close to it, there was all these houses, and it was inevitable, you know, that bombs would fall on houses and things like that. And of course, the propaganda at the time was called it terror bombing, although they were trying to aim at a particularly factory estate. By the natural course of events, some bombs went astray, and houses opposite us were hit and destroyed. All our windows were blown in at home, and the ceilings came down. And this went on for weeks and weeks and weeks. At night, when people were in the shelters or we were cycling around with messages, you could see all the shells exploding in the sky when they were putting up a barrage. You could hear the German aeroplanes and the barrage, and then you could hear, obviously, you could hear the bombs coming down. They were whistling down. And just hope that, they wouldn't hit you.
Did you have a shelter at home?
No, we didn't have a shelter at home, although a lot of people had these, what they called Anderson shelters, which were in the back garden. A big hole was dug, and they put these corrugated iron shelters in and covered them with earth and sandbags. A lot of people had, but we didn't. There weren't many in our sort of area of the road where we lived that had these shelters anyway. So we just took your chance in the house, really. But as I say, all of our ceilings came down and the windows were blown in, not once, but several times. The first time, the next day, the council came round and they boarded up all the windows, so we had to use electric light the whole time until, I think, must have been 19, I don't know, I'd already joined the Navy, when they put the gas back in the houses. And I can also remember these houses that had been bombed and blown up and collapsed around us. The very next morning, all these sightseers used to come down. And where they came from, but they came driving up in their cars, and of course they obviously must have been very rich people, because only rich people could afford cars in those days, and they would look around And I can all remember some of the police and air raid wardens asking them to move on, not to gloat and get out of it because they were obstructing what they were trying to do. I mean, they got most of the people out there anyway. They were just trying to, the heavy rescues were, you know, trying to keep the roads clear and restore services. But this went on for several weeks, actually. And people were saying, well, you know, they've left the church, because St. Gabriel's Church, they've left that, they've got that, that's a landmark for them. So they haven't bombed that, because that stands out. So they haven't bombed the church, because if they once they see the church, they know they're not far from Park Royal. You know, this was the sort of stories that people talked about. And there's a huge block of flats called Acton House, which was backing on to the Great Western Railway. And I suppose it was about, I don't know, it was a luxury block of flats which had just been built before the war started. Well, luxury in those days, anyway. It's a great big square building, about 8 to 10 stories high, shops underneath, and it backed onto the railway. And there again, people used to say they've left Acton House alone because they got spies there, and they're shining torches out of the windows, you know, to the aeroplanes that are coming over. And it's amazing how these hot stories started, and they swept round like wildfire. You know, there were spies in Acton House, they were going to leave, left St. Gabriel's Church, because it was a landmark. And I think it's all, on reflection now, it was all part and parcel of a big government con, you know, to deliberately circulate rumours like that, you know, to perhaps keep up morale. Because there's no doubt about it, a lot of people were thinking, well, you know, we haven't got a chance now. I mean, France is gone, and we're on our own. All right, so we've won the Battle of Britain, but they're still bombing us. And, you know, they ought to ration petrol, because at that stage petrol wasn't rationed. And that's how all these rich people presumably could come and gloat. But generally, but, you know, people were stuck together. Of course, the cinema too. We had, I don't know, 4 or 5 cinemas in Acton town itself. And of course, they still showed the films. And if you wanted to go to the pictures, you could walk into Acton. It took about, I don't know, 20 minutes to walk there. Because the public transport had been disrupted, because Horn Lane, which was the main road from where we lived into Acton, had been closed because there were 3 great big holes which the bombing had caused, and there was no through, you couldn't get through.